Welcome to episode 30 of the Serious About Security podcast for March 11th, 2013.
Brought to you by the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or Sirius, at Purdue University. I'm Preston Wiley, and I'm joined today by Keith Watson and Mike Hill. And Keith has the first article for this week.
So, an interesting article was actually came out earlier, and it was related to a problem with Google's two-factor authentication. And we have recommended Google's two-factor authentication several times in the podcast, and so I thought this was important to talk about. We're certainly not recommending you switch away from it, but this is one where a flaw was found and reported, and a correction has already been made. So hopefully no one was out there exploiting this issue. But it's good to be aware of this problem. So the problem is basically tied to the fact that when you are interacting with the Google website and you enter your two-factor authentication, you use a tool to generate that one-time password, and that password changes every 30 seconds. If you're using an application to talk to some Google service, so you might have a chat application, or you might have you might use Gmail through IMAP. Those you can't enter a password using the one-time password system. They have to have what's called an application-specific password. Now, those passwords are generated through the two-step verification tool, and it allows you to generate dynamically a password, which Google will generate for you, and then you can just cut and paste that password into whatever application you're using, and then you can name it. So you might say, well, I want to use this application-specific password for Google Chat, and you might create another one for your IMAP system to talk to Gmail, for example. The problem is that these passwords have complete access to your Google account. So regardless of what you name them for and how you use them, just having access to the application-specific password gives you access to the entire account. And so somebody who's captured your application-specific password for IMAP would still be able to use that password to gain access to anything on your account. And so this was reported by a group known as Duo Security, and they actually make one-time password solutions, and they have integrated into a variety of stuff, and they have several products which are very interesting, tied to VPNs and Unix SSH tools, the web, and using Microsoft tools as well. And so they're building tools that run on two-step verification type systems, and so in the process of building their product, they probably came across this issue with Google and reported it. Now, thankfully, Google has already made a correction to the verification system. However, it's not a complete solution. The passwords are still have complete access to the account. That part's not changed. So there's not a way to designate a specific application password for a specific Google service, for example. That would be ideal. These corrections are more of about labeling it. When you create an application-specific password, it actually tells you that password has complete access to the system. And then they made another change to an underlying problem in Google's infrastructure to kind of reduce the likelihood that this stolen application-specific password for a Google account would be able to bypass the two-step verification system. Now, it's not a foolproof solution, but they have made a few changes to strengthen their system. And some of that is related to kind of the OAuth tokens used under the hood to do the authentication. Now, on the Duo Security blog, there's a very, very detailed list of how this attack works and Google's fix for it. And it talks about really the risks associated with this and then provides a couple updates. So I found it very interesting. One, because this is a good example of a responsible notification. There was a problem. They went to Google. They reported it. Google corrected it. And then they provided complete details of how they found it, why it was an issue, and what the fix was, and just various updates about it once it had been corrected. So I thought this was good. Obviously, this is a good way to advertise your business, which I think is one thing they're doing, but they're also helping the community out as well. So I found that to be a very interesting post.
Well, I have a comment mainly about application-specific passwords and how they kind of work. If you use the Google one-time password system and you create an application-specific password, you see that password once. And you put it in your application, and you never ever see it again. You basically don't know what it is anymore, unless you can pull it out of your application. So from Google's perspective, really they should only see the same thing using this password all the time. They should never see this password being used by other applications, maybe down the line. So it seems to me like. They would have a pretty good method of detecting this password being used in malicious ways, because you basically have it's essentially generated. You see it, you put it in your application, you never see it again, and that's I think how it was designed to be, so that you couldn't use this in all your applications. But I think the flaw is that. Again, it gives administrative access to your entire Google account, and I think Google knows that these are not as secure as a one-time password. They're two-factor authentication one-time password system, because it's just a password, and I don't think necessarily all their services are forced over a secure channel either, so this password can be potentially seen over the line, which is also a potential problem.
That's true. But I think for the most part, a good chunk of Google services now all use HTTPS. Now, there could be some clients, third-party clients, that don't. But for the most part, most of the Google services in which you're authenticated, those occur over HTTPS. So that while that is always a possibility with some applications, I think it's less likely using Google's services itself.
Yeah, I agree with that. But the password does have to be stored on a device or a medium.
Absolutely.
Or whatever, and that's not
Absolutely.
Necessarily stored securely.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, I'm just... the thing I'm surprised by is that password would get you into everything within Google using the application-specific passwords. That part's the alarming part to me. It doesn't surprise me that it'd work across multiple devices because I've used the system myself. I've not done that, but I could see where you could. You could capture that application-specific password and tie it to multiple applications, multiple devices you're using. But what I'm surprised to read about in this article was the fact that I could turn around and use that to get into my administrative side of my Google account, and essentially I could turn off two-factor authentication. I could change my password. I could completely redo my account using that particular password. That to me seems to be the flaw. You shouldn't be able to go that far with it. It should be contained. So that if you went to do those additional things, it'd say, oh, well, you have two-factor enabled. You now need to enter a code.
Right, yeah. The problem is with these applications that are not set up to handle one-time password systems, you got to have a fallback. And unfortunately, that's the application-specific password. And the fact that it has complete access to your account is kind of a problem. It'd be better if you, when you generated a one-time or a application-specific password, you could designate what service it was for. That would be ideal, but it doesn't do that today.
Yeah, I think it might be something that is going to happen down the line, but I think that's just one of those changes that isn't something they can make in a day.
No, definitely not. That's a more significant infrastructure change.
No, and I think that was the original intent. When you use it, you kind of get the idea that that's how they intended for it to work ultimately, but they probably still need to put some additional things into the software to support it. But, you know, it is quite application specific, and when you create it, you know, the instructions are, you know, create this and put it in your application and forget it. You don't ever need to use it again. You know, you've authorized this particular application on this device using this password.
Yep. Well, that's all I had to say about that. I thought it was an interesting issue. Certainly affects a tool that we've recommended. And it's good to see that there have been some corrections made, but there's still an issue out there. So, you know, the risk is there. It's a little lower today, at least.
Okay. Well, I've got the second article for today. And last week was the Pwn2Own 2013. And we talked about this on a similar podcast a year ago. This was taking place at CANSEC West. And over the course of two days, Java was pwned four times. Probably not too surprising to our audience that Java was taken down like that. Some major browsers, including IE10, Chrome, and Firefox, were also pwned. Opera was not a browser option, and Safari. No one attempted to hack Safari, and there wasn't really any good indication as to why. So I don't know that we would say Safari is more secure than those browsers. It just didn't seem to stir up the interest. Other vulnerabilities were found in Flash and Adobe Reader. So what they did this year is typically they only award the money for the first person that performs the hack successfully. But in this case this year, they actually awarded the money for every instance. So the result of that was a payout of nearly $500,000 was paid out for these vulnerabilities. Additionally, last year in Pwn2Own, Google had actually pulled out because of the way it was conducted last year, where the vulnerabilities didn't have to be disclosed. So they held their own Pwnium, which we talked about on that previous podcast. Google did participate in Pwn2Own this year, but they also still held a separate Pwnium competition. And the award for breaking Chrome OS in this case would have been $pi million. So $3.14 million would have been paid out. However, no one was able to successfully crack into that. So I think some good things came out of that, and I was just seeing that Firefox and Chrome have already patched their browsers as a result of the Pwn2Own competition. So IE10 still has not been patched, so I assume it'll probably be in one of the Patch Tuesday rollouts, so they may do something a little sooner than that. But overall, I've seen some mixed opinions on whether this is a good thing or not to pay for these vulnerabilities, and I'm of the opinion that I think this is really good. It's a good venue for, this is not much money for any of these vendors to pay out to find these vulnerabilities, and they're able to get them patched and update the software versus some of these being released in the wild and taking longer to find. So what do you guys think about this?
Well, from my understanding is these issues that are found in this contest are not publicly disclosed. They're disclosed to the vendors, and then they're paid the money, and the vendor has the opportunity to fix them before they go out into the wild. So I think that's a good thing, that they're not publicly disclosed until they're fixed. The other thing I was going to say is Java's gotten a pretty bad rap lately, and probably rightfully so. Just tons of vulnerabilities have been coming out on Java, and I think Java's days are numbered now. I mean, I think any new developer that starts developing applications would be insane to start creating anything on Java just because of its bad press. And I don't even know how many open zero days there are still out on Java that have not been fixed. But it's pretty bad lately for Java.
Well, it's bad for Java in the terms of web app development, or I should say in terms of the client side Java. Java is still, I believe, the number two most popular programming language, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. What will change probably is having Java applets run in your browser.
All right, I totally agree with that. That's what I'm referring to. Web
applications. Okay, well, just checking, because it's not going away, but I think how it's used is. It's just like we see less Flash development today. We've seen a lot less Java applet development. In fact, I only know one thing that I have to use that is a Java applet, unfortunately. But we're seeing more server-side related stuff. We're seeing more HTML5 related stuff. So, but when we talk about HTML5, then there's a whole bunch of risks and vulnerability potentials there. That's new technology, new protocols, and new implementations to support that in all these browsers too. And a lot of, I think, these vulnerabilities could be related to poor implementations of CSS3 and HTML5 too, as well as JavaScript interpreters. So there's still a lot to be afraid of, but you're right. I think Java is kind of diminishing in terms of its importance, as well as Flash maybe. We'll see. But to go back to some of the other discussion points, the amount of prizes is interesting, and the number of successful exploits found, I think, is also very interesting as well. You were going to say something. Go ahead.
I was just going to say I wouldn't be surprised when a day comes when you install Java and it's not enabled on your web browser by default, as just a matter of them changing the way they do things. It won't be relevant as a web browser plugin for forever.
Right, absolutely. It was interesting that both Firefox and Chrome updated prior to the contest. And Firefox went to 19.02, and Chrome had its usually long version number updated as well. So I wonder if those were to catch some last-second vulnerabilities before the contest to kind of reduce the likelihood of somebody breaking it, or what? And it's very interesting.
Yeah, I think that was probably definitely the reason, especially in Chrome's case. With that much money on the table, I wonder if someone had a successful attack in mind, and that patch just a couple days before might have broke it for them, their chance to get a payout maybe. So, another thing I found interesting, and I don't know if this is just the way the contest is designed, but it looks like most of these exploits were also running on Windows. And I've got several articles open here, and I believe that really the only one that maybe could have been executed on Mac would have been the Apple Safari. Even though, Chrome and Firefox can run on Mac, I think they were broken on Windows 7. And I don't know if that's just the way the contest is set up or not, but I find that kind of interesting that that the attacks that were completed successfully were on Windows. I don't know if that's just because it's always been the bigger target, and that's what people are more familiar with. I'm not suggesting necessarily that the Mac is more secure. I find it interesting that no one really went after it. To me, that would have been the advantage in maybe going after Safari, is to say, oh yeah, well, it's vulnerable on Macs as well, because look, Safari's got this bug in it.
Well, I think another thing that's interesting is their definition of what's a payout, what kind of vulnerability is required for a payout. And these are not trivial vulnerabilities. Their definition is you have to have a vulnerability that requires little to no action by the user in order to exploit. So these would be drive-by downloads. You visit a website and you get exploited. This can't involve just them having to click a, go do things or open attachments or whatever in the browser. This requires little to no, maybe clicking a link I think is okay, but anything I think more than that would not be considered a payout by the contest rule.
Another interesting one that did not have any winner was the Google Chrome OS. And for those that may not be familiar, Google makes software to run on very specific hardware called Chromebooks, And if you've ever used one, it's like using a Chrome browser, and that's the entire operating system. At least that's the front end of it, the part you see. And that one had no winning entry, but they have one that they're looking at that may get partial credit. Now, it could be that nobody bothered with it. There's always that. It could be it's actually pretty good. I don't know. What's interesting with the Chromium OS, which is the basis of Chromebooks, is that it does have a very sophisticated security model, and it is tied to some of the hardware as well. So it's designed to be used in a hostile environment. So maybe it's actually pretty secure. I don't know.
So just to clarify, is Chrome OS, does Chrome OS not run Chrome? Is it running a different, essentially, web browser? So a break in Chrome OS is a break in Chrome. A vulnerability in Chrome is not necessarily a vulnerability in Chrome OS.
I believe they are very similar in terms of the web browser side of it. However, there's some more, you know, hardware and system management features that Chrome OS would have that Chrome does not have. But that's a good question. I don't know how closely they're linked. So if one had a vulnerability, if it would be likely that the other one did too, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, and we'll wrap it up. Thanks to Mike Hill and Keith Watson. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.